From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Craft brewers in North Carolina hope to change a state law. It forces them to work with an outside distributor once they grow. You'll learn details of this campaign dubbed Craft Freedom. Now that a Democrat is back in North Carolina's governor's mansion, there could be a greater chance for vetoes. You'll hear debate about efforts to close the state house's so-called veto garage. A Duke University professor recently helped address the question, what killed Middle East liberalism? You learn why he attributes the answer more to history than religion. And we'll feature the surprising lessons an academic learned by working for 4 months in a check cashing store. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper says that he wants to give public school teachers a big raise, and he also says that tax increases would not be necessary to pay for it. But the governor's plan has drawn a pointed response from legislative leaders. Here to tell us all about it is Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Director of Research and Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
What is the governor's proposal for teachers?
More pay. And if there's anything that's inevitable this time of the year, it's a blanket of pollen on my car and discussions of giving teachers more money. And here we are with the governor proposing an increase in teacher pay that would cost around $800 million that would get the regional, get North Carolina up to the regional average and then to the national average in a few years with a total 10% increase.
We talk about averages a lot. Is there any way to put a number on that for the average teacher? How much money a year would this mean?
This would increase their pay up past the $60,000 point. Right now, teachers make just shy of $50,000 a year, and that doesn't include any benefits. That's just salary, and that's just the statewide average. This would increase up to the national average, which would surpass $60,000 per teacher. All things considered, that would get us to the national average because it's important to realize that this is a moving target. Other states are increasing teacher pay, and they're also having effects on teacher pay, such as an aging workforce and attrition in the teacher workforce. So there are lots of factors at play here, a lot of guessing here about how much it would take to get us up to the national average and how much money it would take for North Carolina's teachers to get up to the national average and what that national average would be if we get there.
I'm so glad you brought this up because people listening are thinking, no, wait a second, I'm not quite sure I understand that. It's a confusing issue. And so I guess my question, Terry, is why are we constantly hearing elected officials talk about this national average if it's really hard to figure out because it's a moving target? So is it valid at all?
It's not. It's one of the worst data points in education research, to be completely honest, because if you think about the differences in education systems across the states, they're considerable. You have states that have unionized workforces, and you have those that don't. You have schools that are mainly district-led, small district-led, and some that are county-led. You have vast differences in the way that education is governed in these states, the way that the teacher workforce is paid. The age of that teacher workforce is going to have a huge impact on this average because we pay teachers according to how many years they've been in the business. And the more teachers that have more experience, the higher the pay will be, just because of the way we pay teachers. Not only that, North Carolina doesn't provide additional salary for master's degree teachers. Many other states do. And so that's also going to bump up the pay in some of the other states compared to North Carolina, which has a relatively young teacher workforce. When you try to get all that, take that all that into consideration, it's hard to say that you can come up with something called an average teacher's pay across the nation. And then once you even get that number, you start coming to the realization that it's meaningless because of cost of living. The average teacher in California is making well over $70,000 a year. But I can tell you that in some parts of California, that's not going to get you very far. In North Carolina, the average teacher is making around $50,000 a year. In some places in this state, that gets you very far. And that actually makes a big difference when talking about these issues. But rarely does the media ever talk about not only what goes into calculating the average, but whether it's a meaningful number with cost of living taken into consideration.
So after listening to your description of all the different things that can be thrown into the national average stew, I guess we'll call it, I didn't hear a whole lot of components that have much to do with proficiency of teaching ability or student achievement.
That's right, and that's the other part of this. And when we talk about raising teacher pay, they're usually across-the-board raises. And that does a couple things. It does raise the base pay for teachers in North Carolina. It will increase our starting teacher pay beyond the $35,000 a year that it is now. And more experienced teachers will get paid more. But what it also does, it incentivizes low-achieving teachers to stay in the system, who figure that because it's an across-the-board increase, they can stay in and still reap the benefits of this across-the-board pay increase, when in reality, their higher-achieving counterparts are asking the question, why do I stay in when my low-performing friend down the hall gets paid the same sort of raise that I'm going to get? And then sometimes more, depending on how much experience they have. So there is no connection to student achievement. I really appreciate the fact that the General Assembly in recent years has been moving toward that direction, finding ways to compensate teachers based on their performance. One pilot program, for example, that was instituted recently was increasing third grade pay for third grade teachers who excel at making sure that students in third grade are reading at or above grade level. I think initiatives like that, small pilot programs to see how they're working, should just be the start for the legislature, and they should continue to look to compensate teachers based on their performance so that those great teachers stay in the classroom.
And that, of course, is what we want. And it is curious when we have this discussion at this time of year, budget time, that there seems to be a narrative that we should try to retain every single teacher. You have a different view of that.
That's right. I want the bad ones to go quickly. The idea that attrition is always bad is unfortunately something that a lot of people were convinced of, because they hear the teacher turnover numbers, the teacher attrition numbers, and they say to themselves, it's terrible that teachers are leaving. But if you ask me, the bad teachers cannot leave fast enough, because they are doing real harm to kids that will last for years. So we want good teachers to stay, and we want to incentivize them to stay through not only pay, but giving them additional leadership roles and other ways that they can find meaning in their teaching. But we want the bad ones to go. And if we continue to provide large across-the-board pay increases to teachers, we are going to see our attrition rate, our turnover rate, go way down. But that may also mean that those bad teachers stay in the system, the exact opposite of what we should want.
Now that Governor Cooper has made his proposal for this latest round of increases for teachers, he's gotten a very swift reaction from the leaders in the General Assembly. Tell us about that.
Well, the General Assembly points out that they've been raising teacher pay significantly over the years. In fact, in the last year, there was a 4.7 average increase for teachers, 4.7% average increase for teachers. And over the last few years, they have increased teacher pay by between 10 and 15%, depending on where the teacher lands on their teacher salary schedule. But they've done a tremendous amount of work in raising teacher pay, especially for those entry-level teachers, going from $30,000 to $35,000 a year entry-level. And that's just the baseline. Of course, districts can add more if they choose. They've done a lot of work, and they point out that they're going to continue and had planned to raise teacher pay in the next 2 years. Now, what I think the Republican legislature should do is to – why not outdo the governor? Why not institute a 5.2% increase? which would be politically astute, would make the governor look like he was lowballing it, and make the General Assembly look like heroes. Now, I wouldn't prefer that from a research standpoint, but if from a political standpoint, it would seem like the governors came in at a point that was fairly low, surprisingly, given that his budget is going to be dead on arrival.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Director of Research and Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
When you hear the word crime, you probably think about murder, assault, or robbery. But what about crimes linked to obscure government rules? So obscure, most people wouldn't even know they're breaking the rule. North Carolina has too many crimes like that. Crimes that can lead to convictions just because a person runs afoul of rules and regulations most people don't even know exist. It's a big problem, a problem the John Locke Foundation and Texas Public Policy Foundation are tackling. You can join in Monday, March 13th at noon at the Campbell Law School in downtown Raleigh. An expert panel explores North Carolina laws that turn bureaucratic mistakes into crimes. That's right, an honest mistake that leads to criminal conviction. That's noon on Monday, March 13th at the Campbell Law School. The $10 price includes lunch. Sign up online today at johnlocke.org. Click on events. That's johnlocke, LOCKE.org. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Government regulations can block entrepreneurs from doing what they do best, growing their companies to meet customers' demands. One area in which the scenario has played out in North Carolina involves craft beer. And our next guest has seen the impact of government regulation firsthand. Ryan Self is Director of Sales at the Old Mecklenburg Brewery in Charlotte. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're going to get into how rules in North Carolina have thwarted your efforts to expand. But first of all, as a craft brewer, what are some of the rules North Carolina has in place that govern what you do?
Well, North Carolina is a funny state because depending on which side of the issue they're on, you'll hear some folks crow that we have among the most liberal laws in the Southeast for craft brewers and therefore are one of the best. However, that, of course, makes us one of the worst in the country. And merely being the worst of a bad lot is not anything I think any of us strive for. North Carolina, you can't open a tap room. You can sell your beer directly to the consumer. You can self-distribute your beer to a point, as we'll discuss, but in other states, you can't do that at all, which really limits your growth as a brewer from day one, where there's no organic demand for your product, and yet you're trying to sell your brand to a third-party wholesaler. So, you know, we're not as crippled as some states, but on the flip side, I don't think anyone wants our state to be, again, the best of a bad lot. So the two main things we deal with is, you know, being in the Southeast, there's always some of that taboo around alcohol. No matter how far we've come, there's always some degree of, if you're selling alcohol, it can be problematic. When we were trying to put in our taproom spaces, which, you know, these are places that close at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night on weekends, run up until 3 in the morning. You know, we don't serve liquor. You know, these are not clubs or nightclubs by any stretch. But in trying to get approval for zoning and other things, the city, you almost get treated like, you know, you're a late nightclub sort of spot. And so the taboo that surrounds alcohol in general still always haunts you a little bit as far as folks' ability to see the kind of positive influence you provide as a business. The far larger issue we face and what we're fighting for right now is there is a distribution cap in North Carolina that basically says once we make a certain amount of beer, we lose control of our path to market.
Yeah, and that is really the issue that has drawn most of the attention, because what you're talking about, for those who haven't followed it very closely, basically a very small brewer doesn't run into this problem. But once you get past a certain size, and it's not even a huge size, but once you get past a certain size, you have to involve someone else in your business, whether you want to or not. Tell us about that.
Well, and involve is a very favorable word. And also very small is a very, you know, is a very relative term. You know, we're the largest brewery in Charlotte. We'll do something in the range of, you know, 22,000 barrels of beer this year or so, give or take. However, that makes us less than 2% of the beer sold just in Charlotte, North Carolina. So the idea of us as some sort of major player that's having a seismic impact on the market at large is sort of laughable. We'd like to be there someday. We're obviously facing some hindrances that may keep us from getting there, but we don't consider ourselves a major player at all. We consider ourselves a very small, very compact company, despite the growth that we've seen so far. That number, 22,000, is getting very close to 25,000. And 25,000 is that sort of magic number, whereas you would say we involve someone else in our business. What in fact happens is we are required by law, by state law, to turn over our brand rights in this market to a third-party distribution company, a wholesaler. And that company doesn't produce any goods. They merely act as a logistics company. And they, under franchise law, they own our path to market. And so right now we're selling beer in one city, Charlotte, North Carolina, and sort of the surrounding suburbs only. They would own our path to market in that entire area. And we really have no recourse as far as if we're happy with the work they're doing for us, if we feel like they're properly representing our brand. We have no real recourse to undo that contract. So when it's signed, we're in their portfolio. We're in there with about 100 other brands. And, of course, all those brands want to see their beer sold as well. And so we see a natural flattening effect on every brand. So no matter how much natural organic demand for our product is in the market that we've created, there's a lot of brands, and also a lot of mouths to be fed that are also going to be sold by that distributor as well. And we're going to see a depressing of our impact in the marketplace.
We are chatting with Ryan Self, who is director of sales at the Old Mecklenburg Brewery in Charlotte. So for folks who hear this and say, okay, I'm not really conceptualizing what this means. Right now, how does your beer get to the market? And if you hit that milestone, mm-hmm. how would things change?
So the way we sell our beer to the market is the beer never leaves our hands until it arrives at the restaurant or bar that's going to be selling the beer to the end-use customer. We have our own cold trucks, which is something of an anomaly in the beer business. We know for a fact that unpasteurized craft beer is best fresh. It's best when it's kept cold all the time. A lot of distribution companies, in fact, the vast, vast majority, use room temperature, which, as we know in Charlotte, is 90-plus temperature trucks. And we have our own trucks. We have our own distribution team. We have our own sales team. And we handle that. When a bar and restaurant buys a beer from us, they don't call an 800 number. They don't call reach out to a phone tree, and they don't call a third-party company. They call my cell phone number directly as someone who oversees our sales team, and we reach out to them and get them what they need. And our salesman is in their restaurant or bar every single week checking on it. Our delivery driver's in their restaurant or bar every single week making sure they have beer fresh. The kegs are rotated. So when you're a customer walking into a bar, there's no monolithic company out there trying to service all 40 of those draft beer lines. There's us serving our lines and checking to make sure they're properly served every time so you get the best beer.
And if you hit 25,000, how would it change?
Well, it would make us no different than a company out of California that is shipping their beer across the country to sell in Charlotte, North Carolina. What you get then is a bottleneck, no pun intended, of brands that are both local, national, international, that are trying to sell through one distribution portfolio. And that distribution team has a salesman who goes into the bar and is trying to sell the bar any one of 100, 150 brands. So when my salesman walks into a bar and says, I wish to sell you OMB, and they say, well, I don't want OMB, we continue pounding away at that. We up our efforts. When a distributor walks in, they say, I want to sell you a Sierra Nevada keg. And they say, well, I don't want that. They say, well, then do you want this brand instead? They don't care as long as they sell one of those 100 brands. And so all of a sudden, we go from a dedicated sales force focusing on our brand in a very small territory in our backyard to competing with some national and international brands, some of which are even incentivizing the distributor to push their brand above all other brands. And you get lost in our portfolio at that point.
Sounds as if state government is not only playing favorites to help these distributors, but also standing in the way of a company that would like to expand and keep its current model in place.
Absolutely. You know, we always say that when a distributor sells, you know, a keg of Budweiser, a keg of, let's say Founders beer out of Michigan or Bell's beer out of Michigan, even a craft brand, very little of that money actually stays in the state. You know, the distributor is a local company. But the beer, of course, is imported from out of state, and that money goes back to that brewery out of state. And what you end up with is a massive wealth transfer.
How could the state law change that would make things better for a company like yours?
You know, all we're really looking for is a state to recognize the market has changed. The whole idea of franchise laws and distributors and having these binding agreements between distributors and breweries started in the fact of the tiny little local distributor who was based out of their backyard is going to get trampled by, you know, Budweiser, the massive international conglomerate that is selling them beer. So we need to tie those two parties together. All we need to do now is recognize that the market has changed. 25,000 barrels is a pittance in this day and age of craft beer sales. Let's go to 100,000. Let's go to a number that by the time we're big enough that we may want to go sell in Wilmington and Raleigh, by the time we come to the table with the distributor and want to have a conversation about a business arrangement that suits both parties, we're big enough that we're not getting trampled by bigger out-of-state brands.
Ryan Self is Director of Sales at the Old Mecklenburg Brewery in Charlotte. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlock.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
North Carolina lawmakers head back to Raleigh. There's a new governor in town. Working together or working against each other, they'll make big decisions. Decisions that affect you, your wallet, your home, your business, your kids' education. To keep up with those big decisions, day by day, even minute by minute, look to Carolina Journal. A full team of reporters and analysts. They're watching the action in the state capitol. They're reporting minute-by-minute developments for you. Carolina Journal. It's available each month as a free newspaper and every day with updated stories at carolinajournal.com. You'll find us on Facebook, too. Share items from Carolina Journal. Share items from the John Locke Foundation. Follow us on Twitter, at Carolina Journal. At John Locke NC and at Becky Gray. Carolina Journal, it's your go-to source for news about state government and how government affects your life. Visit CarolinaJournal.com today.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. After 4 years of Republican control of both the North Carolina General Assembly and the governor's office, the state is back to the situation that existed in 2011 and 2012, a Democrat as governor and Republicans running the legislature. That could mean more conflict and more gubernatorial vetoes. Early in this year's legislative session, State House Democratic leader Darren Jackson proposed a House rules change dealing with vetoes.
This particular amendment has to do with what is known as the veto garage that was made popular during the 2011-2012 session. And what it would say is that once a bill is put on the calendar for the first time for consideration of a veto, it can only remain on the calendar for 5 days, and it would avoid the situation where bills stayed on the calendar daily, every day, for months after months after months. They were actually We had several other special sessions that were set up during that time period to come back and possibly deal with redistricting if we had to. So some special sessions we had scheduled, we didn't really have bills to consider. But they remained on the calendar, and then, lo and behold, one night at, I think, about 1 a.m., we did a veto override. I'm trying to avoid that.
Republican House Rules Committee Chairman David Lewis had a response for his Democratic colleague.
I have the following concerns. One, as Representative Jackson and the members of this committee knows, if a bill is passed and sent to the governor and receives a veto, the veto is returned to the chamber that originated the bill. So if it is a Senate bill, it would not come to the House, and we'd really have no control over what they did with the bill. So to the extent we can, we try to conform our rules to be as close to the Senate to make this a functional General Assembly as we can. So with that in mind, and the fact that the Constitution on this issue is silent, now, does that mean that I personally think that the situation that Representative Jackson described is the best way to govern? I don't. But the fact that the Constitution is silent as to the procedure that we use, and the fact that the Senate rules would be in conflict with this, and therefore I think would make it largely unenforceable, I would ask you to vote this amendment down.
That's Republican State House Rules Committee Chairman David Lewis. He's explaining why he opposed a Democratic measure. It would have limited the number of days the House could spend considering whether to override a gubernatorial veto. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment. When you hear the word crime, you probably think about murder, assault, or robbery. But what about crimes linked to obscure government rules? So obscure, most people wouldn't even know they're breaking the rule. North Carolina has too many crimes like that. Crimes that can lead to convictions just because a person runs afoul of rules and regulations most people don't even know exist. It's a big problem, a problem the John Locke Foundation and Texas Public Policy Foundation are tackling. You can join in Monday, March 13th at noon at the Campbell Law School in downtown Raleigh. An expert panel explores North Carolina laws that turn bureaucratic mistakes into crimes. That's right, an honest mistake that leads to criminal conviction. That's noon on Monday, March 13th at the Campbell Law School. The $10 price includes lunch. Sign up online today at johnlocke.org. Click on events. That's johnlocke, LOCKE.ORG. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. You don't have to be much of a scholar to know that political life is much different in the Middle East than in the United States or Europe. But why? It's a question a Duke University economics professor tried to help answer during a recent forum at Dartmouth. Professor Tamura Karan addressed the question, what killed Middle East liberalism? His answer lies in the region's history.
The roots of the weaknesses of contemporary liberalism in the Middle East lie in Islamic institutions, specific Islamic institutions, not in Islamic theology or in the Islamic belief system. I want to emphasize that. Islamic beliefs have been quite flexible over the past 14 centuries. They remain quite flexible today. Part of the reason is that Islam as a religion is decentralized. There's no Islamic Vatican to keep beliefs homogeneous. Islamic liberalism has remained weak because institutional checks and balances in the region are weak, and they are weak for historical reasons.
Karan first addressed something called a waqf, spelled W-A-Q-F. It was a type of trust set up under Islamic law to provide a public service.
Given that waqfs came to control vast resources securely, they might have become powerful political players. They might have constrained the state in the Arab world, in Iran, in Turkey, elsewhere, by resisting actions harmful to their constituencies. The resulting decentralization, these waqfs these thousands of WACs all across the region were founded independently and controlled independently by different families. They might have placed the Middle East on the road to liberalism and democratization. In Western Europe, cities and guilds and universities organized as nonprofit corporations or charitable corporations served exactly that political function that the WACs might have served. In constraining central governments, they became agents of democratization. However, for all their wealth, WACs remained politically powerless, absolutely powerless, for several reasons. They had to deliver specified services and use resources according to fixed instructions. Unlike corporations, they had no standing in court as an organization. WACs could not use, it's very important, could not use resources for political ends. This is unlike an incorporated European city or an incorporated European church. European cities, churches, guilds were free to participate in politics. A WAC was not. And finally, whereas the constituents of a corporation could replace a poorly performing leader, like city dwellers replacing a poorly performing mayor, the constituents of a WAC had no say over the caretaker. And the caretaker was not accountable to them. If he was monitored at all, it was by the state. The bottom line is that in the Middle East, the suppliers of social services, and these were WACs, these were not municipalities. There were no municipalities in the region until the second half of the 19th century. They did not constrain sultans, nor did they foster political movements or ideologies.
That's the voice of Duke University economist Timur Karan. He's explaining why Middle Eastern countries have not developed the same type of liberal democratic institutions as Western countries. In addition to the Islamic Trust known as a WACF, Karan focused on the commercial sector.
Until the 20th century, profit-making enterprises in the region were tiny and short-lived. Commercial enterprises in the region, this surprises many people when they hear it, until the 20th century, commercial enterprises with five or more members were rare, and none of them lived for more than a few years. For centuries, however, Europe had been forming trading companies and banks as perpetual organizations through capital provided by hundreds of investors. All large profit-making companies in the Middle East that existed at the beginning of the 20th century were either foreign-founded or they received substantial foreign help, and often they were headquartered not in the region but in Europe.
Why did businesses remain small?
Two Islamic institutions, laws that are part of what is known as the Sharia, accounted for the pattern and its persistence. First, resources were pooled through Islamic commercial partnerships. A partnership member could pull out at any time unilaterally. The partnership's premature dissolution, which was possible at any time, imposed costs on other partners who wanted to stay in. So merchants and investors minimized the risks of premature dissolution of enterprises by keeping their partnerships small and short-lived.
What was the second institution?
The second institution that has mattered enormously, that mattered because it kept enterprises small and short-lived, is the Islamic inheritance system. The Islamic inheritance system is egalitarian by pre-modern standards. Because of this egalitarianism, sudden death of a member of a partnership forced remaining partners to deal with a large number of heirs. They tended to be numerous. It's typically not a single heir, like the oldest son of the deceased partner, as would have been the case typically in Europe. So merchants and investors kept partnerships small and short-lived, also to minimize the probability of dealing with many heirs. Jointly, these institutions played a role in the Middle East economic Middle East economic underdevelopment. But it's the political consequences that is relevant here. Tiny and ephemeral Middle Eastern businesses could not bargain with the state, as large firms in the Middle East, in Western Europe, did in the centuries leading up to the Industrial Revolution. And their lack of permanence inhibited the formation of business associations. That, too, hindered the development of civil society. If you look at the history during the second millennium of democratization and liberalization in Western Europe, you will see that business associations played an important role. You didn't have analogous associations in the Middle East, so there were no commercial organizations that could bargain with sultans and effectively constrain them.
Karan recapped the two main factors that limited the development of liberal institutions in the Middle East.
The two problems are that the provision that social services were provided by politically powerless organizations, not by nonprofit corporations as in Europe historically, and secondly, historically, the private commercial sector in the Middle East consisted of tiny ephemeral companies. There were no large companies until the 20th century, or profit-making corporations. Why is this important? Because you didn't have economic players that could constrain the state.
That's Duke University's Timur Karan, helping to answer the question, what killed Middle East liberalism? We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. After she worked in a check cashing store for a number of months, a university professor has concluded that there are rational reasons that people choose to use something like a check cashing service rather than a traditional bank. Now, this conclusion is no surprise to John Sanders. He is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Regulatory Studies, but it is a surprising conclusion to those folks who crusade against services like this because they say they prey on the poor. John Sanders joins me now to talk about this really interesting story. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me again.
So you blogged about this at The Locker Room, which is the blog of the John Locke Foundation. And as soon as I saw your headline, first of all, it made me want to read it because you said, professor worked 4 months for check cashing store. You won't believe what she found out. So,
well, I had to borrow from a clickbait headlines to see if it worked.
That's right. So first of all, explain to us, what's the difference between a check cashing service and a bank?
Well, essentially, it's a service where someone can take their paycheck and for a fee get it cashed for themselves. And they're not going into a bank. They don't have a banking relationship with this company. That's what they do.
So they don't have a checking account or anything like that. They just go into a storefront, basically, and take in a check and come out with cash.
Mm-hmm. And they don't have to worry about hidden fees if they make a mistake or something like that. So that's one of the reasons why they prefer that service.
John, when you read this story about this professor, why did it catch your attention in the first place?
Well, I always like stories like this anyway, but it catches my attention because of the work that I did on payday lending, which is illegal in North Carolina. And it's illegal based essentially on what I consider economic paternalism. Payday lending, check cashing services, these are things that people of upper to middle income or higher incomes, we don't really would want to do something like that. That doesn't seem like a very good idea to us. And because of that, we think that it's not a very good idea for other people, for people of lower incomes with less options. And we worry about, for example, with the payday lending, it's usually used, they say that the APR for those things are effectively 400%. But these are loans that usually are 2 to 4 weeks. They might have a high service fee to go along with them, but it's not like a 400% annual APR because it doesn't go annual.
So these are the types of services, whether it's check cashing or whether it's payday lending, where a lot of folks may not be attracted to it, but there are some people who find it useful. Yet you've got this group of folks, John, in society, and you are not among them, but this group of folks that thinks that these shouldn't be legal services because they prey on the poor. But this professor decided to test this out. What'd she find?
Well, she found that the poor and the people that use these services had rational economic reasons for doing so. One, they liked the cost. They thought that overall it was saving them money. They knew the cost up front, so they liked that it was transparent. And by saving them money, it means they weren't hit with any surprise cost after the fact. They weren't hit with a fee if they made a mistake or sometimes you get these banking fees that you're not expecting, or maybe you just weren't paying attention to the fine print, that sort of thing. They like the fact that it was you understand exactly what you're going to cost up front. And also they like the service. Those services, check cashing services, tend to be very helpful, tend to be very friendly services. They understand their clientele, and they appreciate that. They may be suspicious of banks.
I thought it was interesting in the story that was part of your blog on this, that issue of relationship with the check cashing teller and the store itself seemed to be a really important one to folks who operate in that industry.
Yes, and I think that's something that people of upper, and higher incomes don't really think about, that sort of relationship can be quite important.
And I think there was, in fact, one CEO of a company who commented in this story that you linked to something about we work on volume. So it's really important to us to have a relationship where our customers are coming back again and again and again versus someone maybe who's using traditional banking and seeing things as more of a commodity transaction rather than a relationship.
Right. And it also kind of, I think, bespeaks a suspicion of the type of person who would get into that business. Thinking about it from the aspect of you're trying to take advantage of the poor and prey on the poor, no, they are trying to have a business relationship, so they want to invite them in. They want to be good at what they're doing and encourage more and more business. So they're helpful. They're not hurtful.
John, do we know if this professor is planning to publish any material about what her experience was?
I believe the article suggested that she was, and that was one of the reasons why she did that, was that she was working on a larger research project.
Interesting. I know the person we're talking about, and I'm using a cheat sheet here as you and I are talking, looking at your blog. Her name is Lisa Servon, I believe is how you pronounce it, professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania, former dean at the New School. And she has a new book. It's called The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. What's your perspective on the fact that she has now written a book about this subject, the so-called unbanked, people who don't, who are not a member of the traditional banking system?
I think it's very interesting, and it's a good topic for a sociological survey.
So, John, we have a lot of folks that adopt this theory. You use the phrase economic paternalism. Why is that? Why are there people who think that they know better than someone else?
Well, I think it makes you feel smarter, first of all, to think that. And I think people actually are compassionate and trying to look out for their fellow men, but they're doing it sometimes in a way that doesn't take into account that there are options that maybe you don't like that are still rational. When I mentioned the effective APR of a payday loan, that doesn't, even though it's a very high effective rate, which they normally calculate about 400%, but in my research, it's still better than if you have bounce check fees. It could be 3,000 over 3,000%. If you've got overdraft protection, it'd still be 704% doing the same math. If you end up not paying your electricity bill, you would get a utility disconnect fee, which using effective APR math, it would be something like 240 to 420%. Credit card late payments could be 965%. So again, it may not seem like a great option, but it is still an economically rational option if you are in a position that most of us would rather not be.
Interesting too, that I think we can all agree that, you know, one service that you may not prefer to get involved in, or I may not, but someone else may, that somehow or another, some folks want the government then to step in and to prohibit anyone from actually using that service. Pretty heavy-handed.
It is, and like all things like that, where the government ends up banning something, it doesn't take away the option. It just pushes them underground. So then you start looking at other kinds of lenders and loan sharks, and they have, of course, really bad options. That's why they're illegal.
Well, John, I'm really looking forward to more of your writing on this issue. I suspect we're going to hear more from you about this professor's book called The Unbanking of America. John Sanders is Director of Regulatory Studies for the Locke Foundation. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.